All right. Welcome back to the Deep Dive, everybody. Ready to jump into another fascinating case?
Absolutely. Let's do it. Always up for a good legal puzzle.
Well, today's case is going to be a real treat, especially for any law students out there.
Yeah.
We're diving into Crown IT Services, Incorporated versus Koval Olson.
Ah, yes. Crown IT, a classic. It's from 2004, but still so relevant, you know.
Totally. This case really highlights how courts look at non-compete agreements and those tricky liquidated damages clauses, you know, that whole can of worms.
Oh, yeah, it's a big one. And it's not just about the specifics of this one case. The reasoning in Crown IT still has a huge ripple effect on how contracts are written and interpreted even today.
Exactly. I mean, think about it. How do courts find that balance between protecting a company's interests,
mm-hmm.
right, versus letting people, you know, work and earn a living? That's the core tension here.
And it's a tension we see playing out all the time, especially in today's world. So, yeah, lots to unpack here.
Okay, so let's set the stage first. Crown IT Services, they were like the middleman in the tech consulting world, connecting consultants with companies who needed their expertise.
Right, kind of like a matchmaking service for tech talent. And in this case, we have Janice Koval Olson. She was working as a contractor, not an employee, which is important, through her own company, Peabody Associates Limited.
Gotcha. So she's not directly on Crown's payroll. Now, their contract had these two really key pieces that ended up at the heart of the whole legal battle. First, there was a one-year restriction. Basically, Koval Olson couldn't work with any of Crown's clients for a year after their agreement ended.
And then the second part, well, there was this hefty $50,000 finder's fee that would be owed if she violated that client restriction.
Ouch. Yeah, that's a serious financial hit. And the client at the center of it all. None other than Credit Suisse.
Big player. And the defendants, they had a pretty long history with Credit Suisse, working with them through Crown for like 2.5 years. That length of time definitely played a role in the court's thinking later on.
For sure. And the timeline here is also kind of wild. So their agreement with Crown ends on March 1st, 2002. And then boom, just 3 days later, on March 4th, they're working for Credit Suisse, but this time through a different consulting firm. I mean, talk about a quick turnaround.
Yeah, that's pretty bold. I mean, that speed definitely raised eyebrows, right? And it brings us to how this case ended up in the appellate division. So initially, the trial judge actually denied Crown's motion for summary judgment.
Interesting. Now, for our listeners who might not be familiar, a motion for summary judgment basically asks the court to make a decision without a full-blown trial. So why was it denied in this case?
Well, it seemed like the trial judge wasn't totally convinced that Koval Olson's services were, you know, truly unique enough to justify the non-compete. That unique services argument, it's kind of a recurring theme in New York cases like this.
Right, right. Like, did she bring something super special to the table that needed protecting? So when the case went up to the appellate court, they had to grapple with two major questions.
Exactly. First, was this non-compete agreement even enforceable in the first place under New York law? And second, was that $50,000 a legitimate estimate of potential damages, or was it more like, you know, a punishment, an unenforceable penalty?
All right, so let's break down how the court approached the non-compete.
Mm-hmm.
You know, New York has this four-part test to see if these agreements hold water.
Mm-hmm.
What are those criteria again?
Okay, so first up, the duration. The time limit has to be reasonable. Then the geographic scope, that has to be reasonable too. Third, the covenant needs to be necessary to protect the legitimate business interests of, you know, whoever's trying to enforce it. And lastly, it can't hurt the public or be unfairly burdensome to the person being restricted.
Makes sense. A lot to consider. So in Crown IT, how did they apply these rules to that one-year ban on working with the client?
Right. So the court, they looked at it and said, okay, a year in the tech consulting world, that's pretty reasonable. They factored in things like the usual length of projects in that industry and how fast tech changes. So the takeaway here, courts consider the specific industry and its typical timelines when deciding if the time limit is reasonable or not.
Interesting. So it's not just a blanket one-size-fits-all approach? And what about the geographical restriction? Was it a total ban on her working in a certain area?
No, it was more specific than that. It only restricted her from working with Crown's clients, and in this case, that meant Credit Suisse. So since it was targeted at a particular client relationship and not a broad industry or region, the court considered it reasonable.
Okay, so that makes sense. So then the focus shifts to that third factor, the protection of legitimate business interests.
Yeah.
How did Crown convince the court that they had a real stake in this?
This is where things get interesting. The court really emphasized how much Crown had invested in building that relationship with Credit Suisse. Time, money, effort, the whole nine yards. They basically said, look, Crown has a right to prevent former contractors from swooping in and taking advantage of that established goodwill, especially so soon after the agreement ends.
Right. Like, they didn't want someone else reaping the benefits of their hard work, especially right after the contract ended.
Exactly. And the court even used the word poached, which really highlights how they viewed the defendant's actions. They saw it as a deliberate move to capitalize on a relationship that Crown had nurtured.
That's a powerful word, poached. So for our aspiring lawyers out there, what's the lesson here?
Documentation, my friend. If you're a company, keep detailed records of everything you do to develop and maintain your client relationships. This kind of evidence can be crucial in court if you ever need to enforce a non-compete.
So the court basically saw the defendants as benefiting from Crown's efforts without putting in the same legwork themselves.
Pretty much. And because the non-compete was limited in time, geographically focused, and meant to protect a legitimate business interest, the court said, yep, it doesn't create an unreasonable burden or harm the public. All four boxes checked.
Okay, so the non-compete passed muster. Now let's talk about that $50,000 finder's fee, or as we lawyers call it, the liquidated damages clause. Courts tend to be pretty skeptical of these, right?
They do. They're always on the lookout for clauses that are basically just trying to punish someone rather than genuinely compensating for a loss.
So what's the legal bar for these clauses? What makes them valid in the eyes of the court?
Two main things. First, the amount has to be a reasonable estimate of the actual damages the injured party would suffer if the contract's broken. And this estimate, you have to make it when the contract's signed, not after the fact. Second, the amount can't be way out of proportion to the actual harm caused.
So how did Crown convince the court that $50,000 was legit?
Well, they came prepared. They showed the court their projections, internal documents, that estimated that serving a former client for a year could bring in over $200,000, and Crown's cut would be about $50,000. So it wasn't just a random number they pulled out of thin air.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But didn't the defendants inadvertently provide the most compelling evidence in this case?
Oh, absolutely. Oh. This is where things get really juicy. The defendants, in a twist of irony, submitted their own invoices totaling about $150,000 for the work they did for Credit Suisse in the 9 months after leaving Crown. Talk about shooting yourself in the foot. Their own billing records basically prove that Crown's $50,000 estimate was actually quite conservative.
Wow, that's incredible. So the evidence they used to defend themselves actually ended up supporting Crown's case.
It's a classic example of be careful what you submit as evidence. And the court saw it too. They said, look, the $50,000 isn't unreasonable compared to what the defendants actually earned. Plus, remember that finder's fee language. The court pointed to that as well, saying it suggested the fee was more about compensating for lost business, not punishing anyone.
Fascinating. So for all our future lawyers listening, what are the key takeaways from Crown IT when it comes to drafting and litigating these kinds of agreements?
All right, so lesson number one, be specific. When you're writing a non-compete, tie it directly to specific client relationships, not some vague industry-wide ban. The narrower and more focused it is, the better your chances of getting it enforced.
Specificity is key. What about when you're actually in court trying to prove damages? What's the best strategy there?
Keep meticulous records. If you're a company, document everything you do to develop and nurture those client relationships. It shows you're serious about protecting them. And as Crown IT beautifully illustrates, sometimes the best evidence comes from your opponent. So be ready to use their own records, like invoices or client lists, to your advantage.
So always be thinking a few steps ahead in litigation. Now, for those practicing in New York, are there any specific nuances from this case to remember?
Yes, definitely. The unique services standard, it's still a big deal, but Crown IT shows us that demonstrating a deep understanding of a specific client and having strong ties with them, like the defendants did with Credit Suisse, can meet that bar, even if your technical skills aren't all that unusual.
It's about those relationships, that deep knowledge.
Yeah.
So taking a step back, what are the bigger legal and policy issues at play here? What's the core conflict that courts are constantly grappling with?
It's that age-old struggle between protecting companies and their investments, right? And on the other hand, ensuring that people have the freedom to work and build their careers. Courts are always trying to find that sweet spot, that balance between those competing interests.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And how does a case from 2004, like Crown IT, still apply in today's world, especially with the rise of the gig economy and all these independent contractors?
The principles, they're still super relevant. The gig economy is built on these contractor relationships, and companies still need to protect their client base. Crown IT gives us a framework for how courts might approach these issues in our modern context.
It's like a blueprint.
Yeah.
Now, that brings up an interesting question about remote work, you know, with people working from anywhere. How do the principles from Crown IT apply when those client relationships are virtual, spanning different locations? Definitely something to think about.
Definitely. It's a whole new landscape. Now, let's highlight some of those key quotes from the court's decision.
Absolutely. What are some of the most impactful statements that capture the essence of their reasoning?
All right, here's a big one. An employer has a legitimate interest in preventing appropriation of client goodwill created at its expense. That's the heart of why the court upheld the non-compete. Then, on the liquidated damages, they said, $50 wasn't a penalty, but a proportional estimate. Defendants' own invoices proved it. Again, highlighting the power of that key evidence. And lastly, to address the scope of the restriction, they said, the covenant didn't ban all work, just specific client sites for a limited time, emphasizing its reasonableness.
Powerful stuff. So let's bust some myths. What are some common misconceptions about non-competes and liquidated damages that you often encounter?
Oh, there are a few. First, people often think that all non-competes are automatically void, like they're always illegal. Not true. Courts scrutinize them closely, but under the right circumstances, they can be enforced. Another misconception is that liquidated damages require a precise calculation of losses, like you need a crystal ball. Again, not true. It just needs to be a reasonable estimate made in good faith when the contract's signed. And lastly, some people think that New York courts never uphold client-specific restrictions in non-competes. Crown IT proves that wrong. If you can justify it and it's reasonable in scope, it can fly.
So lots of nuances to keep in mind. Now, after our deep dive into Crown IT, what are the core learning points for our listeners? What should they really take away from all this?
First, understand those reasonableness factors that New York courts use to analyze non-competes. Time, geography, legitimate interest, burden, they each matter. Second, never underestimate the power of using your opponent's own evidence against them, like those invoices in Crown IT. Third, remember there are legal differences between employee agreements and independent contractor agreements, although Crown IT shows that similar principles can apply. And finally, consider the strategic use of motions for summary judgment. They can be a powerful tool to resolve cases efficiently when the facts are clear.
Great advice. So, to wrap up, what's the key takeaway from our deep dive into Crown IT versus Cavall Olson?
The main takeaway is that well-defined, client-specific restrictive covenants, along with reasonably estimated liquidated damages clauses, can be upheld in New York. The key, specificity, show the court you've invested in those client relationships and you're more likely to get the protection you seek.
Excellent. And with that, here's a final thought for our listeners to ponder. As the gig economy grows and work arrangements evolve, how do we balance the need to protect companies while ensuring that individuals have the freedom to pursue their careers and grow professionally? It's a complex issue with no easy answers. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.